Charges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, Building Bridges, a fireside chat by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1935, discussing the Works Progress Administration program to fight unemployment. But first,
a look now at the Depression and a federal project that spawned great art with Susan Quinn, who's written an extremely interesting and important book, Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times. And Susan Quinn, now, you know, it's always remarkable to me that depression, that times of adversity can really spur forward such incredible production in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the period of the Depression was a remarkable instance of that. And what I want to begin with is just a little bit about the Depression itself and then the evolution of the WPA and what it was, and of course then your specific emphasis from the Works Progress Administration on the Federal Theater Project. Do tell us a little bit about the Depression era.
Well, the Depression era has always been vivid to me because my grandparents lost their farm during the Depression. Of course, it began in 1929 with the stock market crash, and then after that, the banks collapsing and unemployment soaring to 30%, 50% in the cities, people losing their homes in much greater numbers than now, even though now is, you know, a crisis, but that was just a crisis many times multiplied, and people traveling east, traveling west on the trains looking for work. Just a very desperate time, and a time when it looked like actually our whole system might fall apart. Roosevelt said when he was elected that someone told him, well, if you succeed now, you will be remembered as the greatest president, and if you fail, you will be remembered as the worst president, to which Roosevelt replied, if I fail, I shall be the last president. People truly felt that, that the crisis was that deep. Out of that, Roosevelt crafted this New Deal with these massive programs, including the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, which was the largest public government program in history. 8.5 million people were employed doing all kinds of construction, thousands, hundreds of thousands of miles of roads, the Triborough Bridge, LaGuardia Airport with its wonderful murals. That was the art part of it. Many, many schools, many, many parks that we have today.
Let me slow it down a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's get into, for those who may not remember, and I'm sure there's plenty of folks out there who don't,
yes,
and that is how the New Deal really was initiated, how it evolved, leading to really the creation of the Works Progress Administration, which, goodness, how I wish there was the vision,
yes,
to initiate such a project today, but we'll get to that a little bit later on. But how did the kind of New Deal evolve, and out of that, the WPA?
Well, the New Deal is actually 75 years old this year. It was what Roosevelt pledged. I pledged a New Deal for the American people, and very quickly after he won in 32 in this enormous victory over Hoover, he began to put these programs in place in those first 100 days. The big debate of that presidential election was whether the federal government should step in at all. And Hoover and his people saw the whole thing as socialism or communism. Until then, people really didn't see much of the federal government, except when they went to the post office. So this was a huge change. And the New Deal initiated a whole safety net that we rely on today, and did it very quickly.
What do you mean we rely on it today?
Well, for instance, Social Security, all kinds of the minimum wage, and many of the programs to regulate banks and to regulate the stock market. All of those programs were initiated, and also all the programs to employ people, which we have lesser versions of now.
And, of course, lesser versions of the regulation of banks and so on.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes. And the same arguments have come back. You know, should the states do it? Should private enterprise do it? Those were the arguments in 1932. These arguments for less government, those were the arguments of the Hoover administration. But in 1932, those arguments were lost in a big way when Roosevelt came in. And people, as Will Rogers said at the time, as long as Roosevelt does something, we don't care. Even if he sets fire to the White House, it's okay because we'll say at least he's done something. That's what people were feeling.
Gee, that sounds familiar.
Yes, it does. There are many, many familiar themes here.
Oh, there are indeed. The only thing that's not as familiar is the kind of level of creativity in response to the deepening economic crisis mm-hmm. that is unfolding within this country and within the world community. But I want to move now from the Works Progress Administration, right, the largest mm-hmm. New Deal agency, to actually where Congress funded the Federal Theater Project in 1935. How did that evolve, and what was its mandate? Because, gee, it was exciting.
It was exciting, and a rare, unique moment, really, in our history. And a lot of it had to do with Harry Hopkins, who was the head of WPA and Roosevelt's right-hand man, and who was committed to the arts. He said that art adds to the wealth of the nation. I think that's a wonderful idea. Mm. And that artists have to eat, too, very practical. So he had this idea that art needed to be part of the WPA, and it took up a very, very small part of the budget. The Federal Theater Project was one of four arts projects. The Writers Project, which produced this American Guide series, which we're still familiar with. It's a wonderful series of books about the state. And, of course, the Artist Project, which produced many murals, which are still around, Music Project, and then the fourth was the Theater Project. And in many ways, it's the most ephemeral because theater, once it's over, is over. And yet, during that time, it exposed hundreds of thousands of people to very exciting theater. And its head was a really interesting woman, a daring woman named Hallie Flanagan, who turned out to be a really brilliant choice to direct the project.
Now, I just want to get into some of those theater productions, because some of them that I remember and had the opportunity to read about and so on, and one to see, one which I'm sure some of our folks out there might know, the Cradle Will Rock and stuff, but as a whole, these products actually really, and they were attacked tremendously mm-hmm. later on by McCarthyistic sentiments, etc. They were about defying segregation. They were about the inequalities and inequities that led to the Depression. I mean, mm-hmm. they looked at the root of the system in a very progressive way. And how was that allowed to happen? And what spurred that melding of art and politics?
It really was, I think, Hallie Flanagan's vision, along with Harry Hopkins, and of course Eleanor Roosevelt was also a big supporter of this project. And right from the beginning, they'd had this very progressive racial policy. They insisted on integrated audiences everywhere, which at the time was not usual. There were these Negro units, as they were called at the time, all over the country doing really interesting theater, and there were integrated units as well. And you mentioned Cradle Will Rock. That was one of the really memorable Federal Theater productions, but also one of the most famous is the all-black Macbeth that was produced by Orson Welles in Harlem. At the time, Harlem was suffering almost more than anywhere else. The unemployment rate was just enormous in Harlem, and the Federal Theater Project, with this and other productions, became the largest single employer in Harlem, and produced one of their productions was this Voodoo Macbeth. It was an all-black Shakespeare, which in itself was new, and removed from Scotland to Haiti. So Macbeth was Toussaint Louverture, and the witches became voodoo magicians. And the whole thing was a huge success, first in Harlem, then on Broadway, and then it toured all over the country and played to integrated audiences all over the country. So that was one of many exciting productions of the Federal Theater Project.
And aside from Hallie Flanagan and stuff, I'm still, like, digging at the kind of enlightened race policies that the Federal Theater Project held to it. It really was incredible. And to go into Harlem, the black production by Orson Welles, yeah. I mean, what was the character and nature of the times that was allowing for things that I think still are not real and prevalent in theater today.
Right. Well, Hallie Flanagan said real theater, to be worth its salt, has to have a fair amount of gunpowder in that salt. It has to really push the envelope. and do the unexpected and the unconventional. And I do think it was that vision that vision plus the feeling of desperation. This was a desperate time. Anything seemed possible when things were so difficult. So I think it was possible to do more daring things. Also, she insisted, rightly I think, that the Federal Theater needed to be relevant to what was going on in people's lives. And that was the reason for doing these living newspapers, which were documentary productions about issues that were real for people. For instance, there was one about slum housing. There was one about the crisis on the farms. There was one about the whole issue of public versus private ownership of power and electricity, which was a very pressing issue at the time. And remarkably, even though these sound like dry subjects, the Federal Theater managed to make them very lively with this living newspaper format, and also to employ a lot of people. And that was the first mandate, was to employ theater workers. So what's remarkable is that often the Federal Theater succeeded in employing a lot of people doing original work, not doing the old familiar chestnuts of the road and of vaudeville, even though a lot of the actors they were employing came from that background.
And one of the other things that I thought was particularly interesting that you get into is that the FTP helped black workers get into what were previously all white unions.
Yes, that's right. There's a great story that John Houseman tells about the Voodoo Macbeth production in Harlem. The all-white unions were protesting because African-Americans were doing all the backstage work, and they threatened to picket. And Houseman said, if you seriously think you can come to Harlem and picket against black workers, you know, I go right ahead. Needless to say, they didn't. And because of those productions, particularly in New York, black backstage workers broke into the all-white theatrical unions. Mm. Also, some of the actors, including Canada Lee, who became a star later in Hollywood, broke new barriers. Canada Lee insisted on doing non-typical roles and was one of the first to do that. And that grew out directly of his experience with the Negro unit in Harlem.
I can't help but just take us up to contemporary time, because I think it will make the issue of the importance of that project so much more relevant, just visual for us. Mm-hmm. If you contrast it with the National Endowment of the Arts today.
Yes.
What's the difference? What's the vibrancy
that
we saw then
versus... And the funding and the commitment are different. You know, the National Endowment now, I think the budget is $139 million, which in real dollars is a lot smaller than what was devoted to the arts in the WPA programs. And also the endowment has chosen to do very safe things. They do a lot of work in the schools with theater classics. They have a motto, I think, that a child is more than a test score, which is true, but also very kind of a very safe motto. Certainly nothing like the daring programs of the WPA Arts Projects is going on now with the NEA.
Well, I have to say that I'm going to lift a comment from Studs Terkel that said that you have gifted us with a key moment in the history of FDR's New Deal, and it is especially thrilling and revelatory, and that is the work of the arts project of the WPA, and indeed you have, because you've given us the shovels and the jobs and the food for family, and you've given us really the exhilaration that was the theater and the music and the painting and the general lifting of spirits that was part of, that was indeed the WPA. And good gracious, do we need a WPA today. And for any of our listeners who want to study and think about it more, and it's a very funny book, too. This, you know, you've got a wonderful, light, inspired touch that make it kind of delirious reading. And I would encourage people to read Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Did Indeed Make High Art Out of Desperate Times. Susan Quinn, thanks for writing the book, and thank you very much for joining us and enlightening us.
Thank you.
know it may sound funny, and people everywhere running out of money. We just can't make it by ourselves. It is cold and the wind is blowing. We need something to keep us going, Mr. President.
Mr. President. And now President Roosevelt's 1935 Fireside Chat, broadcast on radio to a national audience on unemployment, public job creation, and the pending Social Security Act.
The administration and the Congress are not proceeding in any haphazard fashion. Each of our steps has a definite relationship to every other step. The objective of the nation has greatly changed in 3 years. Before that time, individual self-interest and group selfishness were paramount in public thinking. The general good was at a discount. 3 years of hard thinking have changed the picture. More and more people, because of clearer thinking and a better understanding, are considering the whole rather than a part relating to one section, or to one crop, or to one industry, or to one individual private occupation. That is a tremendous gain for the principles of democracy, for the overwhelming majority of people in this country know how to sift the wheat from the chaff in what they hear and in what they read. They know that the process of the constructive rebuilding of America cannot be done in a day or a year, but that it is being done in spite of the few who seek to confuse them and to profit by their confusion. My most immediate concern is in carrying out the purposes of the great work program just enacted by the Congress. Its first objective is to put men and women now on the relief rolls to work, and incidentally to assist materially in our already unmistakable march towards recovery. Let us keep our minds on two or three simple essential facts in connection with this problem of unemployment. It is true that while business and industry are definitely better, our relief rolls are still too large. However, for the first time in 5 long years, the relief rolls have declined instead of increased during the winter months, and they are still declining. The simple fact is that many million more people have private work today than 2 years ago today or 1 year ago today. And every day that passes offers more chances to work for those who want to work. In spite of the fact that unemployment remains a serious problem, here, as in every other nation, we have come to recognize the possibility and the necessity of certain helpful remedial measures. These measures are of two kinds. The first is to make provisions intended to relieve, to minimize, and to prevent future unemployment. The second is to establish the practical means to help those who are unemployed in this present emergency. Our Social Security legislation is an attempt to answer the first of these questions. Our work relief program, the second. We are losing no time in getting the government's vast work relief program underway, and we have every reason to believe that it should be in full swing by the autumn. I think it will interest you if I tell you what we propose to do in directing it. I shall recognize six fundamental principles for this work relief program. First, the projects should be useful. Secondly, the project should be of a nature that a considerable proportion of the money spent will go into wages for labor. Third, projects that promise ultimate return to the federal treasury of a considerable proportion of the costs will be sought as far as possible. Fourth, funds allotted for each project should be actually and promptly spent and not held over until later years for the spending. Fifth, in all cases, projects must be of a character to give employment to those on the relief rolls first. And finally, projects will be allocated to the localities or to the relief areas in relation to the number of workers on the relief rolls in those areas. For many months, preparations have been underway. The allotment of funds for desirable projects has already begun. The key men for the responsible major portion of the task already have been selected. I well realize that the country is expecting, before this year is out, to see the dirt fly, as they say, in carrying on the work. And I assure my fellow citizens that no energy will be spared in using these funds effectively to make a major attack upon the problem of unemployment. Our responsibility is to all of the people in this country. This is a great national crusade, a crusade to destroy enforced idleness, which is an enemy of the human spirit generated by this depression. Our attack upon these enemies must be without stint and without discrimination. No sectional, no political distinctions can be permitted. It must, however, be recognized that when an enterprise of this character is extended over more than 3,100 counties throughout the nation, there may be occasional instances of inefficiency, bad management, or misuse of funds. When cases of that kind occur, there will be those, of course, who will try to tell you that the exceptional failure is characteristic of the entire endeavor. It should be remembered that in every big job, there are some imperfections. There are chiselers in every walk of life. There are those in every industry who are guilty of unfair practices. But long experience in government has taught me that the exceptional instances of wrongdoing in government are probably less numerous than in almost every other line of endeavor. My friends, the most effective means of preventing such evils in this work relief program will be the eternal vigilance of the American people themselves. I call upon my fellow citizens everywhere to cooperate with me in making this the most efficient and the cleanest example of public enterprise the world has ever seen. It is time to provide a smashing answer for those cynical men who say that a democracy cannot be honest, cannot be efficient. If you will help, this can be done. I therefore hope that you will watch the work in every corner of the nation. Feel free to criticize. Tell me of instances where work can be done better or where improper practices prevail. Neither you nor I want criticism conceived in a purely fault-finding or partisan spirit. But I am jealous of the right of every citizen to call to the attention of his or her government examples of how the public money can be more effectively spent for the benefit of the American people. Never since my inauguration in March 1933 have I felt so unmistakably the atmosphere of American recovery. But it is more than the recovery of the material basis of our individual lives. It is the recovery of confidence in our democratic processes, our republican institutions. we have survived all of the arduous burden and the threatening dangers of a great economic calamity. We have, in the darkest moments of our national trials, retained our faith in our own ability to master our own destiny. Fear is vanishing. Confidence is growing on every side. Renewed faith in the vast possibilities of human beings to improve their material and spiritual status through the instrumentality of the democratic form of government. That faith is receiving its just reward.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.